Podcast 18, the Ambassadors of Morocco. Single out on the 28th from the Ambassadors of Morocco,
yes.
Of which we have lead singer Benito Priolo in the house. Under the ruse of coming for a few drinks, I dropped it on him that we'd be doing a podcast, and just given that he's lived music all his life, doing fairly well as a British rocker in the modern age. Maybe just share your thoughts on how it's been, your journey, and maybe, you know, what lessons we can learn from that. You know, some of the people that we've had on this show are all about sharing their knowledge and their experiences and some of the successes.
Can I summarise and say it's been very enjoyable, a hard-fought journey, but I can't stop myself doing it because it's what I want to do.
Yeah, that's very vague, Ben.
That's very vague. I don't know.
The alcohol's flowing, so
where
we should
get a bit of it. What gave you that inspiration? What made you think, you know, I really want to do this?
I suppose it's emotional. It's probably emotional basis.
Release.
It's definitely a massive relief. Oh, release, sorry. Relief. The relief comes after the release, yeah. It's definitely that, you know. It's an emotional outpouring, really, like linked to music, you know. But it's also like a vice as well, you know, that, you know, people drink, and you know, but there's a release there. It's like anything, but you know, I found myself attracted to this sort of thing, wanted to do it, carry on doing it. I suppose it's become sort of an addiction. So, yeah,
it's
what I do. It's what I enjoy doing. If I haven't played a gig in a while, you know, I mean, I think I start sort of dipping my, you know, my happiness. And when I've played a gig, I just feel good for the next week. It's like, yeah, it's something that I need. Yeah.
So how far back, when was your first memories of thinking, I really enjoy music?
What got me into it? I suppose it's my parents. They put me up to loads of stuff. Dancing, acting, singing, blah blah blah. But we
you just followed the one that you found.
Well, no, they stuck us into a music school, me and my sister. And we just end up just as an activity every Saturday, you know, something for the kids to do. And I mean, that was partly funded by the council, so you know, the government don't do all bad stuff. Mm-hmm. So, I got involved that way, just sort of.
And we went to the London Oratory School together, and you studied music there, and I remember that.
I did study music there.
You'd carry around this massive cello case with you. Was it double bass or was it the cello?
It was a cello.
The cello.
Yeah, it was a cello. I mean, what you did there was a big example of what happened when I was growing up as well. What's in your back? Is that a guitar?
Are you really small, or is that?
Are you really small? Some people would be like, "That's a cello," and they would like reward themselves by saying, "That's a cello," because they fucking knew, and no one else knew. They're like, "Is that a guitar?" So that was kind of weird growing up as well on the council estate, walking around with a guitar, not a guitar. in inverted brackets, a guitar.
Thought it was a guitar.
Yeah, they all thought it was a guitar. It was a cello, yeah, that was a bit weird. You know, no one was doing any sort of anything like that. funny estate, really.
Mm-hmm.
But,
strings.
But yeah, it felt a bit forced, but I'm really glad that my parents did that, because it made me realise that, I think it was when I was like my start of my early teens, that not necessarily playing like the pieces and doing exams and just like learning that way, playing other people's things, but I eventually just started playing like stuff that I just wanted to do on my own, and I got immense pleasure out of that. I can't describe what that means to me, because it's formed the basis of pretty much the last sort of 20 years, 15 years of my life. So, yeah, it all
clicked.
Right, yeah, that's where the seed was essentially planted, and
that's where the seed
went. This is sort of led my life. It's been the predominant part of my life. It's it's what I've struggled with, but it's what's led me as well.
Did you get good grades for music at all?
I suppose A-levels was a difficult time, but at GCSE I was sort of clued up about what music was, so I do remember being in sort of GCSEs, and there was a mutual friend called James Fernandez, when we were choosing what we were doing for subjects and stuff, and he turned to me in the technology lab and said, "I'm going to do music," and I was like, "Why are you doing music?" He said, "It's because of me. Piece of piss." And that was like, yeah, it would be, yeah. So I just went, right, yeah, that's going to be easy for me. So, and it was really easy for me, but I got really relaxed in A-level time. Then I had a hard time in A-levels. I don't know what it was. I think that's when I really hit puberty, because I don't think my voice broke till I was about 17 anyway. So, that's when
And you were a bit of a class clown.
Yeah, always seeking attention. So yeah, maybe.
I mean, some of the examples of that. I remember he bought like about 5 packets of crisps during one of the lunch breaks in the sixth form common room, and then he just threw them up in the air and shouted "scramble," and then there was this mad rush, and then because of all the, I remember it was a really thin floor, and when you stamped on it, it was really loud, and all the teachers came in, and you immediately got in trouble for that, for the kind gesture of like sharing food with people, you got in trouble.
Yeah, it's amazing that scramble still works when you're like 17 years old.
It would still work now. If you went down Oxford Street and you had some freebies, you just threw them in the air and you went scramble.
Some freebies or some money.
It's in the middle, isn't it?
It's got to be money, though. Money.
I remember before, imagine if I was a Christian, I was a little kid. I was a fucking crazy guy, dude. I remember in school, I used to see people's hands get kicked off for 10p. And people, go 50p, scramble. People don't even know what they're chasing after. Boom, hand, go reach for it, stamp, anything like that. You get me, whoa. So there was a problem, scrambles.
10p.
10p, 50, 10p back in the day. Yeah, the thing is, like you say, people just, it's not even for the money, it's just for the fact that you can, you know what I mean? just try and get.
That's what I mean, the idea of scramble, whatever it is, doesn't have to be money, but you're giving something away.
It's the tribal instinct, isn't it?
The tribal is going for whatever it is.
It's like when you walk in a train station and someone's giving out something, always like have a look what it is. What they're giving
right
away.
We love freebies, isn't it?
They were giving away McVitie's like half chocolate, half peanut butter thing, and I was like, I'm definitely going to help myself to a few of those.
Yeah. One of the secrets to running the pub that bit at the moment. Shots. Yeah. A few free shots here and there. Who gets that in a pub? Last time you got a free shot.
You know when you go away.
And usually one shot follows another shot or some drink. So.
You do get some customers that are clued up and like, you doing our shots tonight.
So how did the guitar? I mean, how did the cello and your piano playing? How did that and then become the guitar?
I suppose it was an escape from. I think I saw the guitar as a popular music instrument, and that was always the music that I wanted to do. Although I was sort of stuck in this sort of classical sort of step ladder, doing your scales, doing your studying and whatnot. And I just picked up guitar and thought, this is an escape from all of that. I can do what I want with this instrument. I don't have a teacher for this. I can do exactly what I want with it. I was like singing along with the guitar. I mean, it's
It's... And then when did it go from copying someone else's music to coming up with your own? And I ask that because when I play a bit of piano and a bit of guitar, you know, I've learned the chords. My dad's helped me out a bit, but when I learn a song, I learn the chords that go with the song, and it's, you know, I'm not at that point yet where I can hear a song and just like figure out some of the chords and then just play along with it, or you know, compose a song myself.
Well, I was always doing studying other people's songs from the get go. But when I picked up the cello and when I picked up the piano, it was always pieces. That's what I learned. So I was always playing someone else's stuff. So, I mean, I didn't go out and go straight for a popular music artist that I liked or anything like that. I was already playing people's music, so I started. I remember the first song I wrote was on piano, and I wrote probably the crappiest lyrics in the world, but I did that on piano because that's what just happened, and probably because I was into popular music, but I didn't necessarily follow someone. When I picked up the guitar, it was a different story. I'd say I was
freestyle.
Just to remember, it was all around the Britpop.
Just to remember the tune.
What?
Just to remember the tune.
Shitty piano.
I fucking don't. No. sorry about my French, but yeah. I was emphasising my happiness at no one with that tune. Because then I would be embarrassed.
So that episode in Friends when Ross goes out to get his old keyboard.
Fucking piano.
And he goes, yeah, I need to go back to get the other cartridge with the helicopter noises.
Oh, shit, cartridges.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Yes, it was that bad, but yeah, that's...
And so what were your influences, like, music-wise?
I say the Britpop scene had a massive influence on me, but...
For example?
Yeah. I mean, I was into Blur. I was into Blur, Radiohead.
Okay,
usual sort of stuff, yeah. Yeah, the usual suspects. I think
I was going to say that when I heard your third track.
Sounds, yeah.
I should have asked you beforehand, what do you think his influences are based on?
I can't remember now, but yeah, we'll chat about that later when we play them again.
But what I will do is I will play the other one I didn't play for you before, but it's Wikipedia, one of my favourites, Ambassadors. And what I'll be doing is I'll be putting up the links to these on the bottom of the podcast. Yeah.
I'm sick of this song, yeah. Spent a lot of money on it. We put our own money into it, like launching it, playing for plug-in and PR and stuff. And so we were quite into it. We kept looking online, what's going on with Wikipedia, how's it doing, you know, is anyone speaking about it? And we found a little bunch of emails. And these were people that worked within Wikipedia about that song saying, we could maybe use this band, like, this is a good song, blah, 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 blah. And then they'll discuss it as we scroll further down the page. This song is not really in favour of Wikipedia. It's kind of negative.
what is the gist of it?
They were discussing about having it for one of their big conferences or something like that.
How funny is that? Just by the name, they just assumed it.
Yeah. I mean, I latched onto it straight away. It was pretty amazing. But the song is essentially about being at work and being bored. So what's the fucking point of being at work if you're just there bored and you don't want to be there?
Mm.
That's what the song's about.
I think you called me and asked if you could come and shoot in the office.
Yeah, maybe at the time, yeah.
Now, for one song it was, so it probably was this one then.
Yeah, probably that one.
Mm. And so describe then the, you know, what kind of successes have you had? You know, describe the evolution, you know, you put your band together. Tell us about that.
I say the successes I've had is playing festivals. I mean, that's still the ultimate goal. But the most success I have is experience. Experience in the whole knowledge of being a band and what it takes and what isn't, you know, what is deadwood to the band. You know, it's a vast experience of what to do and what not to do, and I'm sort of taking that into. I'm playing for a 19-year-old at the moment, and she's got a great voice, but me and another ambassador in the band, we're playing with her. We get on great. We're good mates, but we're sort of bringing that experience to it. So hopefully what I expect to see is that, you know, a more efficient and more no time wasting. Because I suppose when you're in that environment of you're a musician, you're in a rock band, you know, you're most preempting the celebrity that you have in the future, you know, I'll be a diva and whatnot. And what tends to happen is people get locked in a dream world of, we'll get signed up, this will all happen for us because we're so fucking good. Where that's not the case. I mean, I've never thought that myself personally, but it tends to infect the group. I mean, that you can, it can be just one character in the band that think they're so fucking good that it's, you know, it's going to be infectious and everyone's going to love them. But, you know, at the end of the day, it does take hard work. Everyone's got to put a lot of work in. We did a little writing session today, and at the end of the session, we'd only made, like, you know, two possibilities for a song. Everyone's bloody knackered. They were so knackered at the end of it because, you know, everyone puts a lot of thought into what they're doing.
Mm.
But yeah, it takes a lot of hard work.
So how do your jam sessions go then?
Yeah, I mean, it's been an evolution.
Are you at the point now where it's just, it's together, everyone just knows what they're doing, we're jamming away?
It's been a massive evolution since we first started. I'd say I'd have the majority of control over everything that was written, and a lot of it came from me, but as you've gone down the line, I think it's very important that every person in the band feels their worth. And it's not a dictatorship, because collectively it'll mean more, and then collectively more people will put in more. So the end product, if you will, is just, I don't know, just more. It's worth more. It's worth more.
Because you get everybody
collectively, and hopefully that equals more going out there to the person that's listening.
And so where are you now then? You mentioned a new collaboration.
Yeah, it's totally collective nowadays. You know, I mean, I might have the power to veto a little bit more than everyone else, but today I was walking out the band room and saying, you guys just jam, I'm going to come in and just stick some vocals over it, you know, see what happens.
Yeah,
so, and everyone, it's more of a democracy. It's more of a democracy. and everyone's involved. And if, you know, even if one of us were pushing it more, it's within a band, it's like having a relationship with, you know, your partner. It really is like that. I've had to break up with band members before because, you know, someone else has got a problem, or we all feel like they're not right, or they're just fucking around and they're wasting our time. And it is like a, it's like a breakup. It's a full-on breakup. It is a relationship. And I've gone off a tangent. And
Well, how many of the original crew are still there?
Well, just me and the guitarist, who we were the initial. He started the band, asked me to join, and we're the still ones left. But, you know, we've gone through many people to find... you know, common ground, what works. Everyone listens to each other, and you know.
And they have to feel your style of music as well.
Well, no, there's not that. There's not that either. I mean, that's open. It's when four people come from different perspectives. They've got a finer, the common ground of writing that stuff. Mm. So now we've found four people that are laid back, don't irritate each other, just they've got a good work ethic. We carry on with stuff, but you know, mm-hmm. we end up tired at the end of the day. So it means we're putting a lot in. So
someone laid back who's a hard worker and gets on with people.
That's pretty much it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no egos unnecessary. It's just ridiculous. It's just
good respect,
understanding each other's jobs. That's mm-hmm. what you do. You know, yeah. If you're overstepping the mark, let that person know. And that person's got to be okay with that.
Yeah, sometimes it's hard to accept it.
It's fine. That's your opinion. Yeah. Okay, yeah. I respect that. Let's work around mm-hmm. it. Let's do it. But, you know,
Why is that the opinion? You just ask a couple of questions. Do you know what I mean? If you're friends, then you should be able to handle a couple of questions.
Yeah.
You know, and be able to deal with it.
It's really important to be on the same page. Mm-hmm. If people are on the same page,
because too many people listen to their thoughts and then rush off and get all pissed off and start painting the whole picture themselves.
I've come to say, in a band, you're only as strong as your weakest link,
mm-hmm.
and I really believe in that. It's, you know, it's fucked up loads of bands in the past, loads and loads of them. There's always one that will not be as strong as the rest of them, and that'll break it all up.
Yeah, but maybe that's just a natural part of life. Things come to an end.
Yeah, things come to an end. Yeah, that's absolutely right. Yeah.
So, what is your goal?
What is my goal? My goal is the band goal. Band's goal, and we all discussed this. Pretty much, we're gonna write another EP, release two singles, then the EP, and then we're going to try and hit the festivals next year. So if anyone listening runs festivals or events, anything, hit us up, please. We need gigs. Give us gigs.
Is the money good for these events? Or is it more the experience? That's kind of what I'm trying to get out of you. Is it, you know...
No.
Is it you happy just doing the gigs?
No.
We've gone
far too long without any sort of recognition or any, you know... major achievements, and I'm not talking about achievement and money. What we all want to do is play in front of an audience, mm-hmm. a good crowd that want to hear us, and you know, that's what we want to do. So we want to hit the festivals next year where we've got an opportunity to do that. I mean, that's pretty much our dream.
Yeah.
I mean, if I was to go further than that, the ultimate is traveling the world
mm-hmm.
and playing music. But I'd like to see the world as well.
Yeah, definitely.
I'm not talking about money here. I'm not talking about money. I just want that experience of, you know.
And the reason why you want that experience is, as I was saying, is that, you know, it's not the money on the podcast. It's trying to understand the elements of what makes us happy. And,
yeah.
You know, so whether you're doing the money or not, the fact that you're still writing the songs, playing in front of people, and, you know, still with that realistic goal ahead of you, that in itself is the happiness for you. And you know, you've always been very humble, you know, been very realistic as well. So that's,
I think that's important.
So are you happy?
I'm fairly happy. Yeah. I'd like a bit more success. I'd like to play better gigs. I don't wanna sort of play to 5 people in the back of a pub where no one gives a shit. That's kind of dull and a bit of a waste of time.
Because one of the lessons that we got from when my good friend Phil, the Muay Thai coach, was here, he said that the reason why he's been so successful is that when people go to his gym, instead of that impression that, you know, if I'm going to do Muay Thai, then I have to, at the end of it, be, you know, this championship fighter. You know, sometimes the perception of what kickboxing means, yeah, maybe put you off. But, you know, his class is that, you know, let your first goal be that within, you know, 6 months you're going to do your first interclub where it's just with shin guards, there's no winners, and it's, you know, headgear and everything. So yeah, everyone can set themselves their own realistic goals. And once you have those realistic goals, that's where the happiness comes from, because you can chain and work towards it.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
If you have these ideas of grandeur, then, you know, you could be, like, blocking yourself right from the beginning.
That's what I was saying, yeah. There have been members of the band group, you know, in the recent past that have been like that, so...
That's where it goes on.
Mm-hmm. And it's quite funny, because you came out to join me when I was teaching in Inner Mongolia. And, I think that's probably the best time that we had together. It was about... Joe came out with us as well. He's also been on the podcast. But there's these 3 Uyghur foreigners in Inner Mongolia where, you know, there were hardly any other foreigners at all in that region. And I remember the local bar down the road, the movie bar. Yeah. You know, every now and then you'd go in and you would do a little impromptu session on the guitar that they had there.
Yeah.
And there'd only be like about maybe 10, 15 of us in there in that very small bar downstairs. But it's one of those ones where you get to know the owner and the bar staff. And I remember that's some of my fondest memories, just being there, just hearing you jam away. And after a few beers, I'd get up and have a little dance along while you played. Join you in a few freestyle Oasis songs as well. And I know you hated that. You'd hate to do any covers of Oasis and stuff. You know, you'd play your own stuff.
Yeah, it was the only stuff I knew at that time, I think. Yeah. It's good though. Good memories, really, back then. When the days of very little responsibility and just fun. That was...
I called you up and said, there's this opening. All you need is a degree in any subject. And they'll pay for your flight out there. They come and meet you, they bring you to the university, your accommodation's paid for. You get paid way more than any other lecturer there.
No, mate, I remember the day when my mum woke me up, yeah, because I was still living with my parents. She came in, she went, Ben, Guillaume's on the phone for you. He's like, what the fucking time is it? Go away. Yeah, because, you know, young. Yeah, he told me that. I was like, what, you don't need an English degree. What? yeah, it was quite an easy decision. Yeah, I mean, that's essentially what I want to do in life anyway, even if I don't achieve that with the band. But, you know, that's what I'm doing at the moment. I'll go and travel, go see the world, go and visit cultures, because that's pretty amazing. Have you been watching that programme, An Idiot Abroad? You've seen any of that?
Carl Pilkington.
Yeah, he's amazing. I mean, the first series was really good. The second and the third, I'm a bit maybe you're playing up to your character now. I feel like you've been enlightened a little bit to just say, no, I want beans on toast.
Mm-hmm. Or the bag of Monster Munch that he always brings in.
Yeah, he's like, yeah. I don't get it.
He does get it, but like you said.
He bloody does, man. If you've done that shit.
No, but what I like about that is the moments where he is happy and he is content, you feel it. You feel like, oh yeah, you feel happy yourself. Because it's like, finally something that makes him happy.
It'd be the most unexpected thing that he'd like as well.
Yeah.
The guy with like 2 heads in India.
Sure. Yeah. A bit when...
I love him, the freaks, yeah. Yeah.
Well, when he has to dance, he's got such a fun... It's funny.
He danced with lots of people, didn't he?
Like an English lad kind of dance, you know, like a Chelsea boy kind of. And it's like, I love the way he gives 100%, and he's There was a bit where he had to do the that Bollywood movie. It's in season 3 when he travels with the
Maharajas.
With what's that guy, a dwarf? Are you a dwarf or a midget?
You spoil it for me now, aren't you?
You said you saw season 3 as well.
I've seen bits of each.
But anyway, they get on miserably, but they go to an Indian town and everyone comes up to the dwarf and like starts touching his head. I keep calling him the dwarf.
This was on the other night.
An Idiot Abroad season 3. You know when
that's what Pilkington calls him. He calls him the dwarf. Yeah. You can't call him by his name.
Season 3. What's his name? All right, here we go.
Yeah, it was the what do you call it? Gypsies. It's lucky to touch a dwarf, isn't it? If you're a gypsy, that's like their culture.
Warwick Davis. He'd been in Star Wars and a couple other films. You know, as an Ewok. And so, at the beginning of season 3, they find out that he has to go on a journey with him, and Carl Pilkington's really upset about it. He goes, he's just going to slow me down. You know, he's going to hold me back and slow me down. So the first like 3-4 episodes, he's like miserable all the time, and go to this Indian town and everyone comes up to Warwick and starts touching his head and he's from the West, so he finds it really offensive that they're doing that, and they're kind of just like staring at him because of his size. And Carl Pinkton's having the time of his life. Goes, go on, just get involved in the atmosphere, yeah.
I think I saw an episode where there were gypsies and the gypsies had the same beliefs, like touch a dwarf and encompass. Yeah,
this next song is AO Morocco, and this one's just topping in at 37,000 hits on YouTube, so check it out.
Yesterday.
25 years old, mother of two.
What's Bob Geldof going through right now?
Yeah, I think with 25 years of age, but it's one person, and like, there's just all this media coverage.
It's a sudden death.
Because it's like more closer to home, it's quite shocking, and they're just like a young white girl in the Western world with a bit of fame. When she dies, it makes the front page, and you know, a lot of.
Paula Yates was a massive story, wasn't it, back in the day? I mean, and her daughter, she's had kids as well. She's got a family that she's leaving behind. It's like running in the family. It's a bit weird. Fucked. It's shocking.
Former mother.
At 25, it's shocking.
That's one death. And someone sent me this video today about the problem that Africans are facing in Israel. There's like about 1 million immigrants, you know, African immigrants in Israel, and because it's a Jewish state, there's massive, I don't know if it's racism. I think the way the woman that was interviewed, she goes, you know, if racism is me, you know, stopping these people coming in to my country, and, you know, and the way she was describing it, that those that come in are, you know, stealing and thieving and basically doing what they can to survive. And there's massive, hatred and racism, and the footage is really, really intense.
Because the country can't sustain them.
Yeah, and they say that.
That's what they're resorting to, or are they going in there specifically to rob people?
Yeah, but they're saying that, you know, they lose their Jewish identity after a certain, you know, when you mix the population, you kind of make that general.
Oh, right, what? That is kind of racism then, isn't it?
Yeah, because I mean, they do have their own issues with the Muslims as well in Israel. There's massive conflict between the two.
Well, yeah.
But these, I mean, and hundreds of people are dying. You know, like I said, this whole African-Israel conflict. And, you know, we're not even hearing about it on the mainstream media.
No, you'll hear about celebrities and shit. It's the way it is. That's more interesting, what's happening. Mm-hmm. You know, X Factor and all that.
Yeah, or Kim Kardashian.
Yeah, she's a butt plugs.
Yeah, but she has got a big ass.
I've never ever looked into Kim Kardashian. I've always turned the channel, but I see her everywhere.
So I've been Kim Kardashian radio.
Wherever I
look. I'm sure you've seen her tape.
I saw her today. I saw her today with the butt cheeks out on Yahoo.
I bet you did.
Kim Kardashian.
Yahoo, that private browsing.
Hey, Kim can inspire whatever she likes. Yeah. Okay,
but well, that story.
I didn't pay attention to it, but I've heard of Kim Kardashian just simply of the fact that it's just there in my face wherever I look. Yeah. It's on TV. Yeah. It's on the internet. No, you're laughing as if I'm some sort of stalker. But seriously, I don't know what she does for a living. Or anything. I know that she's on a
rag. Every time I'm in the co-op paying for something, I see, you know, with a magazine, it's just Kim or Khloe Kardashian.
It's about Kardashian something. It's like, I don't give a shit about that.
And it's the dawn of the reality TV. You know, all this is Chelsea and Jersey Shore and all those. Chelsea.
Like you said, you know, do people just prefer to switch off and just watch the news stories that are going to make them happy? Or are they prepared for what's actually happening? But you said that's not reported in the big press, but, you know, maybe...
Anyway.
All these celebrity stories are put out to us. Mm. But, yeah, are we... Is it kind of like how the system works? Is it... supply and demand. Do we prefer those stories to look over what's actually fucking happening?
Those people are in the public eye, so that's why it's so interesting. We don't care about people who aren't in the public eye. If someone gets killed, they barely make the London news if someone gets killed.
Yeah.
Only if they get thrown off, like, you know what I mean? Think about it. People must die all the time from something, or whether it's accident or someone being murdered. No one's being reported every day. I know someone got killed a couple of weeks ago in Church Road. No one was reporting anyway. They got shot in the face. You might have heard about it on the local news, on Bread Council newspaper or something, but you're not going to hear it nationally. It's people who want to hear about, you know what I mean, who's in the public eye, who's... Bob Geldof's a big, you know what I mean?
I didn't hear about that story, got to say.
Yeah, I barely heard about it. I heard it from my friend.
More than I would, in the last 2 weeks. So.
Yeah.
I didn't hear that story.
And it's proven that they're on stories they will not deliberately not run stories if they think that it will affect ratings, it's an entertainment channel. If you're talking about CNN, even the BBC, is more reliable than some and most. But it's all about ratings. It's all about viewership and making money. And if people aren't watching it, then they're not making money. So they're set up like they have their boardroom meetings when they have their, you know, this month, you know, we're this percent up from last month on viewership, and, you know. We've got to raise profits, reduce costs, all the same business principles.
They tend to give a big story a bit too much, like, airtime.
What about the missing plane?
Yeah, I mean, exactly. That's exactly what I'm saying. To do the missing plane for 10 minutes, and it's like, the only information you're giving us is that there's another box, there's something beeping, and someone picked it up, and there's another ship out.
That's not really news. You're
wasting 10 minutes of news. It's like, you can just say the search is still ongoing, we haven't found anything concrete yet. Next story. They're not doing that. Yeah, they dwell on shit. Like, there was that massive thing with the baby of the royal family.
George.
I've
seen it.
Yeah. That's been publicised quite a lot. Yeah. All the news people were just waiting out there.
Mm-hmm. It's his first something or another. He's come off the plane and he wants to go for a sleep.
But all the news teams are waiting out there for like 5 days. Just to get one bit of information.
For 5 years. Yeah.
Well, check this out. This is a video recording of a TV host And she decides not to report the facts or news, and she gets particularly called out by co-hosts. So check this out.
Heard about
this. I mean, it's refreshing to hear that there's people that are kind of like, are willing to step out and say, look, you lot are talking the same old bollocks. You're not really giving anyone any new news that's of any importance. And you're just going to do this same old rubbish to try and attract the...
same kind of rubbish.
Exactly. Get your
you're a low-wage worker, struggling to get by, we'll talk to you.
These frustrating adverts. Yeah. I mean, how annoying is it every YouTube video now? Is that you have to wait for this advert.
Yeah, 5 seconds.
Some of them you can wait 5 seconds. Some of them you have to listen to it the whole way through.
Nah, you can get away with that. Reload the page. People, if you don't want to watch the advert, reload the page.
I've tried that, and it just starts
nothing. No, yeah, I've tried that as well.
Nah, man, we have to try a couple of times.
You might as well just wait for it to finish.
Nah, that's like a minute.
I'll just get on with something else.
Why don't we do it now and prove it? Why don't we do it now and prove it then, alright?
Try a couple of times.
Because by the time you're doing something else and just moving it,
sometimes it's not 1 minute 30. It's
really okay. Time to stream. All right. So I'll do your one, the Peter Finch one, yeah?
Yeah, do the Peter Finch.
The advertisement, yeah? 1 minute, you can skip it. I don't know, but you can skip it now anyway. So
is it? Yeah. No, that's
alright.
I'll skip it anyway.
Okay, fuck it. Anyway, the other one's loaded. So, yeah, so check this out, the TV host thingy. Here we go.
The airlines haven't felt the need to do this.
Right.
And two, it's not cost prohibitive, but it doesn't make any sense to do it because this happens so rarely. They could track these planes if they wanted
to. Sure.
It's a lot of money. And by the way, they will from now on.
So she's getting paid
the extra money from now on. But this just never happened.
Can we go to news school for a second, please?
And by the
way, that's last week's question. And the theories are for later in the show. And I'll tell you why. Everyone stop for a second.
Stop and relax.
Everyone.
You just come on.
Stop for a second.
I'm going to ask you to just bring it down and relax a little bit. I think you're
because
a little upset.
Here's what we've got at this point. It's 17 minutes past the hour. We shouldn't be talking about theories. If you want to go to a network that has theories about Pakistan just blared across for hours and hours and hours, you've got many choices
I
out
love
there.
Pakistan.
Okay, but that's actually capitalizing on a non-story for the sake of ratings because people's imaginations are pricked by this, and that's not responsible. We did the plane, we will do the plane, it will be done again, we will do the facts.
Okay, feel like
how do we not know?
Sandler's gonna get the cape and say, come on,
just stop, we've got to go to Ukraine.
Insane, isn't it?
Wow. That was amazing.
Yes.
Nice. Oh, nice one, man. Well, what he said to her. Can you send me a link to that, please?
I posted on Facebook, and what she's referring to is that all day long you're coming up theories on Pakistan, so every time you turn on the news, because a lot of these news channels, people will flip throughout the day. You don't just sit down and watch it because they'll repeat stories. Mm. So you get bored of watching, so you flick through the day. And if every time you log in or you click onto that channel and you're hearing Pakistan theories on, like, you know, terrorism or whatever, you're kind of inciting that, you're reinforcing that terrorism kind of mentality. And the more you see it, and so then when something kicks off, then you're already kind of programmed in that manner. And that's what she's saying. So there's no point in doing it. It's senseless.
Mm-hmm.
Just like the content that they're talking about now. Yeah.
In London, you think, like, the other time, remember, I don't know, there was something, there was like an underground pipe because of all the rain and shit. Something happened in it, like a gas thing, and then it exploded. Everyone, you know, immediately on the radio, interviews and TV, immediately thought it was a terrorist bomb, immediately thought it was a terrorist attack. And you think, what? It was just, you know what I mean? And in the end, it was just something that burst, you know, from underground. It was coming from under the ground, but obviously it caused a big explosion, and everybody immediately thought it was a terrorist attack. Why?
Anytime now something big that happens, terrorism. You know, we couldn't fly, remember, we went to Amsterdam because of the volcano and the ash. You know, when it first started, terrorism.
Mate,
the
latest.
The terrorist volcanoes.
The latest story. I mean, if I can ask you around the table, who didn't think that the missing plane that went missing was might have been linked to terrorism?
Yeah, as soon as they saw the story, they mentioned them two guys and then had passports.
Guys,
they were like, they were traveling on stolen passports. It's like, that will make immediately think, right, cool, they hijacked the plane.
Yeah.
These guys hijacked the plane and they put it in the sea and they're not telling us.
They put it in the sea.
You lot are in trouble.
Oh, shit.
It's like, these guys have hide it. Like, that's what it is. And then they talk about airport security and shit and then it's fuck up our travelling times. Like,
it's all a bit suspicious and,
It really is, man. That plane is gone and they know that it's gone.
Well, there's a couple of things that made to link that something very suspicious, by the way, disappeared, isn't it? So,
MH370. People are saying how it could be something related to money, or you know, some rich people on the flights, and other people just something like that. Or
does anyone have a theory?
What baffles me is that in this day and age, when you have a, you know, you're flying people across the world on these planes, for you to have the technology to fly this all these tons into the air and land it safely,
250 people.
You know, from one specific point in the world to exactly the right specific point in the other world, or 70,000 flights a day, how can you not have something on there that tracks it?
And
it's fine if it's at the bottom of the ocean, but they should have that built in.
My good mate Jones, he said to me, he said that they can track your phone, but you can't find the plane. And it's so true, he told me.
Well, yeah.
Well, maybe they can track it and they just don't want us to know about it. So
hijacked them, they're putting a water.
I'm going to place your example of a phone with a missile.
That's it, a missile.
They can put. They can send a missile into the exact place.
Yeah. Well, the problem is they're not doing it exactly. You know, the drone bombings. There's a high percentage of, like, if you're going for a target, there's about 80 for every correct hit. There's 80% civilian deaths.
No way.
You know, it's very, very random. And you hit. There's a really fascinating interview of a guy that controls the drones.
I think I've seen that as well.
I think maybe you even showed it to me.
I think I may
the drone one. And when they attack it, there's a rough estimate of where you're going to hit. So it's You know, when you have the chance that you're just risking one civilian life, you know, then the whole ethical question comes in. But when you're talking about warfare and how every little advantage that you have on your opponent can be the difference of a thing.
Playing war games, the guys in New Mexico controlling the plane and it's in Pakistan. Hmm. The guys here in, there's, I don't know, the base is somewhere here, they've got one in the UK as well, and they're controlling the drones going around some next place.
Yeah.
And they're killing people. Just control. I've seen this joypad as well. I showed you about the weapons being the drones, and literally the guy is talking about it, and he's like, "Yeah, you know, he's got his face covered; he can't show his face, but he's proper talking about it." And obviously, he has to ask permission before he actually.
Well, I'll turn on the volume, but check this out. This is actually a few years old now, but it's
But I've seen more newer.
It looks like a dog, but what it is, it's a robot, four-legged robot, and it's walking like it as if it were a dog. And not only that, it's carrying like kilos of weight.
Okay.
So they've made this this machine, and you know, just imagine having, you know, rocket launchers and machine guns on the side of this thing. That you can kick it over and knock it off, and it will still stay up. And you know, to get all the physics correct for, like, you know, how to, like, to kick something over and for it to, like, re-stabilize itself. Look, and it's on ice as well. You know, look at that. Look how it's mimicking the mood. Yeah. So just imagine the technology in the joints and everything in order for it to be able to react like that.
It's like a deer, isn't it? The way it moves around.
It knows if there's a hole, it won't put the weight in it, and it will find the thing. When it's weight, then it can move to the next one. And this group called Boston Dynamics,
been programmed pretty well, hasn't it?
They're like leading the way in this kind of technology.
That's nothing. I've seen stuff 2013 of Boston Dynamics. See what they're making now.
Do you know who bought Boston Dynamics last month?
Who?
Google.
Google, yeah. Sorry, I heard about that as well.
You know, so I put on my status, you know, that's the
It's kind of Empire Strikes Back, isn't it?
Yeah, man.
Trust me, that's mine. This is 2008, bro. Check what they're doing now. I've seen the stuff that they're doing now.
Yeah, look at
that. Whoa.
That looks like two guys, actually, like with a cover over them.
That's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
That is fucking phenomenal to see that.
You know,
like back to back.
Taking into account the ice and when the leg starts to give way, how all the weight has to shift in the other leg so that it recalibrates itself.
Just, the reaction is amazing. That is so good.
Yeah, so if you want to find it, just type in Boston Dynamics Big Dog.
Yeah, you got to see it.
You know,
so they've got these little things. Yeah, they're like little robots. They're little robots, bro. If you see how high this thing jumps, you would not believe it. They got it from the floor to the mountain, and it can jump like fucking meters, and it can land, and it has little feet and everything, and you can attach weapons and cameras and everything to it. It's called the Millipede or something like that.
Right, Jason, you're getting excited, so you need to find that on there.
Yeah, so you just go to the channel. You just click on their channel. You can find everything there, man. They've got some mad shit.
Yeah, there was one also.
Hello, Fran.
You good?
Yeah, not too bad. How are you?
I want to be attached to a robot soon. In Japan, they're doing it as well. To the old people. The 70-year-olds and stuff that, like, they want to continue working. They've attached robots to their legs and to their ligaments, so you're able to carry stuff and shit. Farmers are doing it now in Japan. Saw that. That was in BBC Clip, one of your favourite shows, Ben.
Yeah, I saw as well, people that that are paralyzed like from the waist down. Like, they have, like, an exoskeleton.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. Of the guys, like, yeah, 7 years old.
Like they're walking up. Oh,
and he has the exoskeleton on his knees, and it's, like, around his waist, and his wife puts on him in the morning, he goes out, and he's an old man. He's like, and he's picking up heavy loads of shit. He's like, yeah, I feel better now, I can work. And the Japanese government are giving it out so people can work for longer, you know what I mean? And it's fucking crazy, isn't it? And it's not even expensive.
So while they're asleep, they
that is only good work. You're banging it. His foot was fast.
You're suggesting that Japanese robot technology is going to make people into sex slaves.
Yeah. Right. No, it's only
come here, bitch.
Kind of took it a different direction. I was thinking sweatshops and then some different sort of sweatshop, innit?
Sweet shop. Vice did a sick video on the sex industry in Japan. And Japan is one of the few countries in the world where the younger population is getting smaller than the older population.
They sell more human nappies.
Yeah, not baby nappies. Yeah, the average person, they're not having sex or not having the baby, so their numbers are falling, they're decreasing. It's the only population that's happening.
They're selling
to decrease
by 50%. Wow.
They're co-populated in Japan. That's what the documentary said anyway. They said by half in the next 10 years.
Because they're selling each part of the relationship individually, aren't they?
Individually, yeah. You're selling it all the experience.
Cutting a little bit.
Breaking it down, putting a price and selling it off.
Yeah, because you've got the guy, they're like, oh, why are you not in a relationship? He's like, oh, I'd rather buy comics and cards instead. And then one woman's like, oh, it's like the socially awkward people get together to solve money.
Relationships are a hindrance on making your success in life.
Yeah,
so
they see it as something else. So guys like have girlfriends on their phones, and then like they go get a hug from a girl, like in a, you know, that hug.
Yeah, you go into like a shop and you can tick off like dim sum on the menu. Tick off, I want a hug. Stare in the eyes, stroke my arm, stroke my back. So you tick off of what you want.
The man goes in and she just hugs him for like half an hour.
Wow, woman. Yeah. Relationship time is a commodity now as well.
Trust me. Shutting hugs. It's literally selling hugs. $60. Like
buy two, get one free.
Come on. I'll sell you back my friendship to you for 20 quid. Right now. 5 minutes.
I'll sell you.
Throw in a happy ending. Talking.
Does that mean like a joke?
moving very swiftly on. I remember my first casino experience with Ben on my 18th birthday. My dad took us down to the Palm Beach Casino, and for the Palm Beach you can't just rock up, you have to wear a suit.
Yeah.
And it sounds a bit kind of almost not nice, for lack of a better word, that, you know, my dad got me really excited about casino from a very young age, and the whole concept of he would buy chips for us in the house where we had 50, 100, you know, chips, and would mimic all the casino games. So when I went into the casino, I already knew what was going on. But just to see, like, the dealers and the croupiers doing it and all the lights and getting free cigarettes, free alcohol. And
entertainment, man. That was a good thing.
Do you remember we were there for, like...
It was something to experience, wasn't it?
Yes, and it's very powerful. And when you start winning early on, you know, you do like a couple of little bets here and there. But, you know, once you get the winning streak, you get hooked. And all of a sudden, it's like you're taking £100 with you and you're coming out with like 150 or 200.
And then,
we were doing that for a long period of time and you were sustaining it. And I remember I'd come every night, we would take we'd always make sure we'd save enough money for a taxi back to mine. And then Ben would be rocking up to my house in a suit. And then from there, we'd go down into town. And that's when I started playing Punto Banco, or the Baccarat. And you favoured more the roulette. That was your speciality.
Mm.
I remember Marcel Desailly was sat next to me one time, and we were playing playing blackjack. Had a little word with him in French, and I was just mega excited. Because I remember he asked me whether he should take a card or not. And I think he had an ace, he had a soft 16 against the picture. And I said, yeah, take a card. And then we ended up winning. And he said, oh, where are you from? Because I threw in a few French words now and then. You know,
where are you from?
when we lost a hand, I'd deliberately throw in a French swear word just to let him know, you know. Oh, merde, putain de merde. Have a little look over, a little glance over.
So I looked at him, I thought, this guy's earning thousands a week and he's only better than a fiver.
He's better than a fiver on what? Is it? It's a blackjack.
He was blackjack, yeah.
Mad. That's nothing to him. That is absolutely nothing.
Growing a week in them prices over time, 60 at least, 50, 60 in them years.
Good for him, man. Just enjoying the entertainment. Mm-hmm.
That's what it is. Just enjoying it.
Yeah, yeah.
Because
no one's going to win at gambling.
But if you want to go to a place where everyone's dressed up nice, because I remember there was like just like women there with their husbands or just on like having a couple of drinks or in the restaurant. The restaurant was very nice and exclusive. And I remember they would give out cigars for free. I'd always get these Dunhill cigars and everyone would come. And you could actually sit down and smoke in a casino.
Oh, those days. I wish I was.
It's all about Vegas, mate, if you want free stuff. They'll make you. Yeah, man.
When? I need to go.
They'll, you know, they'll heat up some milk and make some cookies, like, just so you can gamble.
Anything you want.
Yeah, they do that shit.
Anything you want. For free as well. What have you guys got on there? I want some.
When did you go to Vegas?
Yeah. I didn't.
Oh.
I just know.
I love how you're telling this story. It's like, I've seen the movies. I've seen Hangover 1 and 3 when they go back to Vegas. I know.
I've got friends that have gone to Vegas.
But I know when people go on holiday, some they like to exaggerate.
Did you go to Vegas?
This is the legend. You just have to have, you know, a handful of quarters to play a fruit machine or something, and you can get drinks free all night.
No way.
Yeah,
I love how you say that with confidence. And
yeah, I'm pretty confident about that. I believe it because I know that we got treated the same. If you want some money,
that's different though.
Because
I remember there was when you had that. I remember one night you came out of that. You won about a grand. Not the big night. There was another night where you.
No, I was just with you.
You came out the one in Bayswater.
Yeah, I was up quite substantially and. We were about to walk out and cash in our chips, and then they said, "Oh, would you not like some lunch?" And they drew us in, and we ate lunch, and then we went back to the tables, and I lost my profit.
That's what happens.
We saved enough for a cab home. It's fine.
Well, I remember we went to, I think it was the same one in Bayswater. I think, I can't remember, the name part of London Club International. But
one of these was the main one,
like on the high street,
18, 19 years old.
Yeah.
Mad.
Yeah. So I think
I've never had
just of the age.
We went in with £100 each and then we went up and down. Then you went down to £50. And then that was when you began the miraculous comeback. Not even the comeback. So £100, then we went down to £50. And Ben had this system, so when you go to some casinos, whether you play roulette or blackjack, there's a little paper on the side where you can kind of track the score, the previous scores, and based on that, you kind of anticipate the next one or do what you can to kind of
worked out. Man. Worked out.
So Ben, there was a picture of a roulette wheel. So Ben
had a 7-2 system. Yeah.
Remember, you cut out the circle, and then he would remove numbers within a roulette wheel, so that once the ball landed in a number, he would swivel this little thing that he'd put together with a little pin in the middle, and then it was all professionally made. So if it was that number, you would like move the thing to there, then all the numbers that it uncovered, you would place the bet on. And from that night, I mean, I remember saying, I was playing Punta Banco, but he kept coming over, he goes, gee, I'm up. So he went down to £50, and then from that £50, he took it up to £5,000.
Mm.
And I mean, that night was crazy, because I'd won a couple.
It wasn't £5,000, it was £1,000, and I bought dinner for everyone.
It wasn't £1,000. And do you know how I know it wasn't grand? Because you gave me £1,000 for my uni fees for that year. Yes, you did. Is that how bad your memory is?
Yeah.
So let me retell the story. You won. Okay, so maybe it was about £4,000, but it was definitely four, at least. And then of that four, you gave me £1,000. Because the meal that you took me and my dad out to, and my sister.
Right, okay, let's tell this story. Right. Okay. When I was with you and the guys, I won £1,000. And we went to Chinatown and we bought milk. When I was by myself and into it, that's when I won £6,000 by myself. That's when I won £6,000 by myself. I made two, and then I decided I'm going to try and gamble this up, and got to six and left the casino.
Okay.
Not knowing what to feel because I just won so much money.
But I remember you definitely gave me the grand.
Yeah, I took you guys out to Le Gavroche.
Le Gavroche. It's one of the most expensive restaurants in London. And my dad would... Because you came quite close to my dad at that time. And he, you know, he was kind of, unfortunately, mentoring us in the gambling world. But, he, you know, my dad would always talk about these great fancy restaurants. And then he harped on about Le Gavroche. And that's, you know, one of these really swanky French restaurants in Mayfair. And it's one of those ones where they come out at the same time and it has that bowl on top of the dish and they all open it up at the same time. So all the food's revealed at the same time.
I didn't spend that much money on a meal, but I did, yeah.
It was like £100 a head. And then we got a bottle of wine, I think.
I paid your tuition fees and then the money was gone very shortly.
No, it wasn't just that. I remember you went back to the casino and I think you didn't have a good time.
Well, yeah, exactly, yeah. Money was, it wasn't that. It was like, it was back at the casino thinking, I'm invincible, I could win loads and loads of money. But, you know, reality hit home there.
And once you're in there, once the money converts into chips, it's now a game, it's not money anymore.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. It doesn't mean a thing.
So whether you're playing with £1 chips or £25 chips or £100 chips, you still got that amount of chips and you play down to your last chip, so it's all relative.
It's like you think, I could have bought this, 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 but at the time it's just a game and there's no money involved. It's just excitement and theatre. Yeah, it's weird. Yeah. And I'm never going back there.
Yeah.
That's fucked up. Yeah. Gambling is for stupid people. Definitely.
And on that bombshell we ended the podcast. So Ambassadors of Morocco, support them as much as possible, guys. You can follow them on Twitter at Ambassadors Band, all the other usual media, Facebook, iTunes as well. Please subscribe, that really helps out. And their latest song, Lost All Interest, will be out on the 28th of April, a couple of days' time now. Go down to iTunes, purchase a couple of songs, and do your part in supporting. And we'll see you on Podcast 19. Thank you very much.